Today is Friday, January the 9th, 2009. This is Leroy Chatfield, director of the Farmworker Movement Documentation Project, which is located on the internet at farmworkermovement.us. This oral history recording is another in our series entitled, Who Was Jim Drake? With me for today's interview are Richard Cook, Bruce Meyerson, and Herb Eli. In 1972, they worked with Jim Drake in the course of his campaign leadership to recall the governor of Arizona, Jack Williams. I want to thank our interview guests for their participation today and would like to remind our listeners that this oral history interview about Jim Drake will be published on our website, farmworkermovement.us, and can be found in the oral history section. To start the interview, I will ask each of our guests to give us their names, tell us something about who they are, and then describe for us when and under what circumstances they first met Jim Drake and what were their initial impressions. Richard, let us begin with you.
Thanks for the opportunity to take part in this, Leroy. I really appreciate it. My name is Richard Baldwin Cook. I was on the staff of the National Farm Worker Ministry with Jim Drake, and Chris Hartmeyer as director, and a number of other really fine men and women back in the 70s. I first met Jim in Florida. This is a little bit of an aside. I had forgotten this. I was thinking I'd first met Jim in California after I had joined the Farmworker Ministry staff, but my memory was jogged not long ago, a couple of days ago, and I was working in a migrant ministry in New Jersey and went to Florida for an organizing meeting for the National Farmworker Ministry, and Jim was there. Chris was presiding. That meeting prompted me to want to join these guys and move to the West Coast. But Jim was sitting there, the row behind me, and we were talking about putting a budget together. Most of the other people present were church officials that managed various parts of national Protestant denominational budgets. And the question came up of how much of a budget was needed for the farmworker ministry, and one of these very well-intentioned and ultimately quite helpful individuals, I'm sure, was suggesting that there didn't need to be much of a budget. And I remember Jim stood up. We weren't following Robert's rules, at least as far as Jim was concerned at this moment. He stood up. Jim was a very big man, an imposing man. And he turned around and he pointed at this guy and he says, "I'll tell you why we need to have a budget. I have to eat." And that pretty much ended a discussion about why the budget needed to be as large as it was. So Jim knew how to make a point and to, in effect, take over a meeting for at least part of the discussion. And that impressed me with Jim. You can't do that all the time. You can't do that every day of the week. But Jim did not have a lot of patience for distractions and a lot of time that he wanted to waste on preliminaries. He wanted to get down to work. That was my first encounter with Jim Drake. Must have been in the spring or the summer of 1971.
Okay, Bruce, what about you?
Well, I like Richard, appreciate this opportunity, Leroy, and it is so nice to visit again with Richard, and I'm very excited that we could involve Herb. I graduated from law school in 1972. I was from Arizona, and I wanted to return to Arizona to become involved in public interest law and public service work. And a mutual friend of mine and Herb's in Washington introduced me to Herb, who was then the chair of the Democratic Party. And the most exciting thing politically that was going on in Arizona at the time, and this is now the summer of 1972, was this recall movement against the then Governor Jack Williams. And this is something that the Democratic Party supported, and Herb really was a strong advocate for the farm worker movement and thought this was an important activity. And when I met Herb, we really were not at a point where we could do public interest law, but Herb guided me into this this recall movement and introduced me to the farm worker representatives, among whom was Jim Drake. And through a series of conversations with Jim, I wound up doing a number of things in connection with that recall movement. Number one, I worked as a lawyer along with the UFW attorney Jim Rutkowski. And I also, and this is sort of the main contact I had with Jim, had to do with creating a citizens committee to support the recall effort. And I became the director of the citizens committee. We had two co-chairs, one a fellow who is now a U.S. Congressman, Ed Pastor, and another former a nun, Sister Mary Rose Christie. And so what struck me about Jim, first, as Richard mentioned, his size, that big mustache that he had, but it was the kind of the dichotomy between Jim as a very thoughtful and soft-spoken person on the one hand, but a very dynamic person on the other in terms of his presentation at meetings and gatherings. And so Jim was the person who really engaged me in the day-to-day activities of this recall, although the truth is I really work with Richard mostly, and maybe we'll talk about that some more, but I think it was really more Richard who he and I worked more closely as far as at least the signature gathering process, which was the significant activity that we were engaged in during that summer.
Herb, what about your first meeting, Jim Drake?
My relationship.
First of all, I'm sorry. Please tell us a little bit about yourself. I jumped the gun there.
Well, Bruce is correct, and before I talk about Jim, since this is a documentary of the United Farm Workers Movement, what should be very much understood in a very salutary sense is that this movement spawned transcendent things of benefit to the public that sometimes happens, even though the recall movement, quote unquote, failed in the sense that there wasn't a successful candidate, but it was very successful in other ways, because at the time, Bruce is right, and I'll give two examples. I was chair of the Democratic Party, and what was happening to the farm workers in Arizona was of course a disgrace, and we were involved both in various ways. I was in my official capacity as chairman in the recall effort, and in going out and picketing from time to time and on the fields, and that was involved with Jim Drake and his leadership. But what I was alluding to is a result of the efforts that were put forth by the recall effort, the United Farm Workers Movement, and Bruce Meyerson in particular. We forged a relationship and started the most effective state public interest law firm in the country, as a direct result of frankly my seeing the talents and the commitment of this man to the farm workers movement. In addition to which, as a result of the farm workers movement, there is a direct relationship between Hispanics being involved in Democratic politics, to which now in Arizona they have dominant roles not only in the party politics, but in elective offices and influence in elective offices, and that's a direct result of the movement. As I said, my relationship with Jim was all involved in the recall movement, And Jim Drake, and if I have a chance during the course of this interview, I want to tell you what I think is a very interesting anecdote that talks about his commitment to the movement. But Jim Drake was as committed a human being to a cause, but with logic and earnestness and a projection of gregariousness that he was able to organize many other people and influence many other people. The most concerned individual in a cause that I have ever known in my life. And this was directed, of course, to the United Farm Workers Movement and to the recall movement in particular. Just one more matter, which we can get into later. My relationship with Jim was made more intimate and significant when Cesar Chavez had asked me to be the candidate for the recall movement, which is a story that I can talk about a little later in this interview, but is a prelude to an anecdote that I want to tell about Jim Drake and his character and commitment.
Thank you. As I think about this, and I was there in Arizona in 1972 when Cesar was fasting, and I was working with Cesar Chavez at that point, I have never heard of a recall campaign against a state governor led by a United Church of Christ minister. It almost sounds bizarre to me. I'd like to ask about the background. How did this happen? How did this come about? Why would the governor of Arizona be a target for such a recall election? And why would Jim Drake be leading this campaign? Richard, if you could start off again, I'd appreciate it.
I'll be brief, and I'm going to defer to the Arizona residents to pick up this as to why the recall might have been prompted by the actions there of the governor and the legislature. But my role in this, from beginning to end, really was kind of as a soldier, and I don't have except anecdotal information that's been passed to me as to how the union determined to begin the recall effort. I could share that, but I wasn't part of any of the planning. I had begun work with the National Farm Worker Ministry only in January of 72, having moved Barbara and I and our two children, our infants really, from New Jersey to California. And in the spring of 72, I was simply told, you're going to go to Arizona. And so that was pretty typical of the way the Farm Workers Union under Cesar Chavez's direction made staff decisions known to the affected staff. But as to why it was decided to do that and what had happened preliminary to that in Arizona, perhaps Bruce and Herb can share that. And I'm looking forward to
that. I can start, Herb. Do you want me to start and you can add,
Bruce.
Want to start?
No, you go ahead.
I'll just start. And what happened at that time, Leroy, was that a number of states, including Arizona, began to consider legislation that made it difficult, if not impossible, for farm workers to organize into unions. And Arizona, as it was then, and although less so now, had a significant agricultural industry here. And so this legislation was introduced into our legislature. Cesar Chavez came to Arizona and wanted to speak with our governor and explain why this legislation was unfair to farm workers, and our governor, Jack Williams, snubbed him in effect and refused to meet with him. And so this not only led to his fast here in Arizona that occurred during the 1972 presidential campaign in which many national dignitaries came, but it led to a strategic decision by the farm workers to take a stand, so to speak, here in Arizona, and the decision was made, and I wasn't part of this, so I really can't tell you how the decision was made, but the decision was made that a way to try to stop the spread of this legislation throughout the Southwest and other states was to convey a message that the Farm Workers Union wasn't simply going to roll over, and the way it expressed that message was through this recall effort, and that's that was the origin. Now, Herb may have been part of meetings that led to that. I don't know, Herb. Maybe you were.
Well, Bruce is very accurate. I just want to add to that. There was a unique set of circumstances in Arizona in the sense that we not only had a reactionary governor, but we had a hostile one newspaper town press. I have a cartoon which I'm looking at in my law office where I am that was published in the Republic, among others, which shows Cesar Chavez pointing to some of us saying, "I cooked it up and it's mine." Cooked it up means recall Governor Williams' political pie. That's what they refer to. And the reason that it was effective under the leadership of the farm workers, the United Farm Workers, the reason it was effective is because there was a coalition of forces, as is shown by this scurrilous cartoon, which in my perverse way I love, that because it showed that it entailed in people on a liberal-minded people, because there was, an addition to everything else that Bruce has said, there was one specific event, and that is that Jack Williams, the then governor, declared John Birch Day in Arizona. And that was an anathema, because the John Birch Society at that time was a potentially powerful reactionary force, supported again by the Arizona Republic, the newspaper, and Gene Pulliam. And so the timing of the recall was very propitious in the sense that it was able to mobilize and ennoble a lot of these other groups to join in the recall movement. And that's why Bruce is right and Richard is right in the sense that the farm workers started it, but it was coalesced with a lot of other groups, again under the leadership of the United Farm Workers, and particularly Jim Drake as being the leader in main agent in the field that made it effective. And Jim was, as I said before, had his head politically astute and was able to tap into these various sources to coalesce and to make this recall movement very significant.
In 1985, Jim Drake gave an oral history interview to Pat Hoffman, who was working on a book. And in that interview, he said that he has two claims to fame in the farmworker movement. The first one, he said, was it was his idea to start a boycott in 1965, in December of 1965, against Schenley Liquors. And he did that. And he said his second claim to fame was that he had the idea and sold it to Cesar Chavez that the governor of Arizona should be recalled. And so I just passed that along for your information about what Jim thought about his own role in the farmworker movement in terms of his claim to fame. I'd like to talk about, or ask you to talk about, how was the campaign organized? What was the plan? How many volunteers worked in this recall campaign? What did they do? How did they do it? Tell us about the campaign itself. Who wants to start with that?
Well, Richard really was intimately involved in the day-to-day operation. Maybe he should start, and I have some things I could add to that. But
I'll start it off. But I'm going to defer to anybody who wants to jump in at any time. I was one of the first to arrive from California and followed by several other union staff. And one thing that occurred to everyone pretty quickly was that there needed to be and there would be a lot of recruitment of local people to work on the campaign. And so that was begun right away. And for probably every person who came in from another state to work on this, there were half a dozen people at least who were recruited and put on put to work in Arizona. And these were young people. A lot of them were Hispanic folk from South Phoenix and then from ultimately from Tucson and other parts of the state. The campaign was organized to gather signatures door-to-door at shopping malls and at other gathering places throughout the state of Arizona. I remember we went up to Indian Country. We went to, that may not be the right term for that, but there are a number of reservations, and we actually hired some young Navajo men to work on this campaign on the reservation there. I remember trips to several of the other reservations as well. Ultimately, the structure of the campaign, and Bruce and Herb may need to correct or modify what I say now, but ultimately there was a coordinator in Phoenix, and I did that job. There was someone put in charge in Tucson, and Nancy Makoviak, I believe, was the first person, if not the first, the person who was working in Tucson, coordinating the staff there. And then there were others who worked in other parts of the state. But Jim was overall in charge of the effort, I believe, from beginning to end. Not quite to the end. I think when he left the state, when he left Arizona, Nancy Makoviak was ultimately put in charge because I was reassigned as well. But Jim was there for... Until the signatures were turned in to the Secretary of State. And all of us have anecdotes that we can share about what it was like to deal with the registrars of voters and what it was like to deal with members of the public in gathering these signatures. But I do want to mention one thing about Jim that struck me and always impressed me about Jim, and that was when he was speaking to staff, when he was running a staff meeting, when he was letting everybody know what the plan was, you had an enormous sense of confidence that what Jim said was going to get done. If Jim said it, then he didn't have the charisma that someone like Caesar uniquely possessed, but Jim could inspire confidence in people to get up and get out the door and do a very hard job day in and day out. And you would do it because Jim needed it done.
I think, and maybe we'll just go with this same order if that's easy. I think what I would add to what Richard is saying is that I think Jim also recognized the political dimension of this. And so not only did the workers who were gathering signatures for the recall gather those signatures, but they also registered voters, and I want to have Herb in a second. I'll tell you about one of the great legal victories he had on that. But so hundreds of thousands of voters were registered at this same time. Now, regrettably, in the 1972 election, many of them did not vote, and so those names were purged from the ballot, and that was a big factor for Herb and as he assessed whether he should run in if there were to be a recall election. But so the political dimension of this was significant, and it plays into what Herb said about how this recall effort changed the political horizon and landscape here in Arizona by engaging so many more young people and Hispanics into the political process. And Richard, you may remember, but I can remember going to meetings of all of the workers who were gathering signatures, and we would invite political candidates to come to those meetings. And many candidates actually came to the meetings because they wanted the support and endorsement of the UFW, because they knew that would mean, you know, workers and enthusiastic volunteers in their campaign.
That's
so
right.
It sort of segued from not just a recall movement, but into a political movement as well. My job, a little more specifically, and then I'll turn it over to Herb, was to serve as the director of this citizens committee, and so I was to go out and get commitments from different organizations to be a part of the recall committee, and then we would issue press releases every time we had a new organization join. One thing that Richard said about, well, you know, he was assigned to go to Arizona, so he just, you know, he showed up here. And I think that's what happened to all of us. We were sort of given a mission, and we did it, no matter how sometimes foolhardy it may have been. For example, I took the bar in the summer of 1972 and was asked to organize a rally for Cesar Chavez at the home of Ev King the weekend before the bar exam, which I did. While I was waiting for the bar results, we decided that we would make a demand for the governor to resign. And so here I was, a 25-year-old kid just out of law school waiting for the bar results, and I was holding a press conference calling for the governor of Arizona to resign. You know, how smart was that? So we did kind of crazy things then, and I don't know, and I think probably the most exciting thing that I can remember, and I don't know if Richard can remember this, I'm sure he was there, I don't know if Herb was, but this probably happened in the spring of 73, after we got these signatures, and we got, I say we got, really Richard and his, and the volunteers got, you know, over, you know, hundreds of thousands of signatures, and we presented them to the Secretary of State, Wes Boland, in the state capitol, and had a rally down there, and where we announced the proclamation for a better Arizona, which I read from the balcony of the old state capitol. So anyway, so I guess my point to make to get to the point here, Leroy, is that there was a political dimension to all of this beyond just simply you know, collecting signatures and a recall movement.
And Herb Eli here. Leroy, I just want to say Bruce almost paid a major political price, because he became a subsequent to that a very distinguished Court of Appeals judge, and Jack Williams never forgot his role and opposed him in the state Senate for confirmation, fortunately not successful. But I think the most important thing of Jim Drake's contribution and the recall movement is something that Bruce capsulized, and I alluded to, but Bruce said it better. It changed the face of politics in Arizona. With respect to specifics of the recall movement, I want to say something personal, and then I want to tell you my anecdote that I think sums up in a at least a metaphorical way of Jim Drake and his commitment. Cesar Chavez came to my house with his two German shepherds, Welga and Boycott, to ask me to run for governor. I was just coming off the state chairmanship, and it was very difficult for me to make a decision. But I think that it for myself, for my own values, I just didn't have the commitment that in effect I was going to give up a legal career to do it. So I told Cesar candidly that I would. Let him know in a very short period of time, because he needed a candidate. The recall movement was growing. As Bruce said, there were all kinds of rallies. I remember we had a major thing with Cesar in my backyard, and all kinds of things going on in the state, and all kinds of people getting involved in it. And so I made a decision, but I felt I didn't want to call him or communicate secondarily. I wanted to go over and see Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta, and I needed to do that for my own moral sanctity. Well, in the process of doing that, I was picking up Jim at the airport going over to Los Angeles. I picked up Jim, and Jim didn't know what I was going to do, and said, "Well, you decided that you're going to run?" I said, "No, Jim, I want to tell you, and I owed it to Cesar, Chavez, I've decided I'm not going to run, and I will explain. I'm happy to explain it to you, but I need to explain it to Cesar Chavez in person. And Jim said, let me out of the car. I said, we're on a freeway. Well, then get off and jet me off at the next stop, because in effect, and that's what I did, because that's what he wanted me to do. We maintained a relationship after that, but the beauty of that truthful anecdote is that Jim was so committed to this movement that and Cesar Chavez and what was being done that he could not comprehend how someone like me would let the movement down. And as I say, it eventually it didn't affect our relationship, but it was that kind of commitment that he had. I do want to add one other thing to this discussion, and the name needs to be brought out here. The person who did run and sacrificed, in effect, to a large extent, a legal career, was Jerry Pollack. And Leroy, in answer to the question of the recall movement itself, because I'm a very close friend of Jerry and continue to be to this day, he sacrificed himself for the movement by walking, as Richard knows, all over this state for months at a time. I think it was 7 or 8 months until the recall movement eventually, as Bruce said, didn't make it. But this was a most successful movement in any way you say it, because so many of the Hispanic leaders of today were groomed and bred on this movement and the passion of this movement.
You know, since we're doing a history here, Leroy, if it's okay, you'll indulge me. I want to add a couple of things here to what Herb has just said. We went first to Bill Mahoney, William Mahoney, who had been a big Kennedy guy and was an ambassador to Ghana, and he was sort of a local aristocrat, and he turned us down. So Jerry, we then went, and he was smarter than Jerry Pollack. But so then we went to Jerry, and I don't know, Richard, if you were at the meeting, but we went to Jerry's office. We sat around his conference table. I think he was very taken by and honored, I think, really, by being asked. We explained to him we wanted him to run. He got up. He went to get his calendar, and he looked at his court calendar, said he could fit it into his schedule. Now, he didn't ask about, is there going to be any money? He didn't ask about, are we going to have any staff? He didn't ask about the media. So Jerry was such a committed guy himself that the essentials of the campaign didn't mean anything to him at that point. I think he was so impressed and honored by being asked if it fit into his schedule. He was running, and we had this crazy campaign, Leroy, where we walked around Arizona. And Richard, were you still here during that?
Oh yes.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah. And so they would walk, and the problem, Leroy, in Arizona, as you know, is that half of this state is desert. So if you kind of visualize the scene, Jerry and a handful of people walking through the desert, where there were no voters. So it was it was quite an interesting campaign strategy.
Oh, it's okay. Good to be able to laugh about it after all these decades. But it was serious business when we did it, I'll tell you that.
Well,
Bruce, I think if Leroy, I'm sorry to interrupt, and we'll follow your direction, but I want to give Bruce a chance, since he talked about his beginning his law career in Arizona, to mention the first case you've ever argued, Bruce, as I recall.
Well, no, now which one? Well, the first one that I argued, you may be thinking another, was actually the one where I met my wife. was the Safeway boycott? Was a Safeway boycott case where I came in and was asking the judge to modify a court injunction that prohibited our workers from talking to people outside of Safeway, so people could not talk to customers, and so we argued that, of course, that violated the First Amendment, and it was the first case I argued. So my mother came. And then a woman, Mary Ellen Simonson, who's now my wife, came as a reporter. And so she somehow got talking to my mother. And my mother sat behind her during the court proceeding, and so every time I made a good point, my mother kept nudging, because pushing Mary, say, see, good point, good point. So she kept hitting her in the back. And so,
by the way, Bruce, you may not remember, but Mary Ellen wrote an article on the recall movement for the Nation magazine.
Right, exactly. And so we're getting a little off the subject here. I'm sorry, but Richard got me thinking. And so then Mary Ellen, you know, was interviewing me, and you know, one thing led to another, and we've been married 35 years. And was that the one you're thinking of, or were you thinking of something else?
I had that one in mind, but I was thinking of the case that was argued before the Arizona Supreme Court.
Oh, okay. Oh, on the recall petition.
On the recall, yeah.
So that was exciting, and between Herb and I and Jim Rutkowski, you know, we had all kinds of litigation over this recall, and then I got sued as a result of the recall when I accused the Attorney General and others of engaging in a conspiracy to prevent us from filing our petitions. I ultimately got sued for defamation.
I didn't remember that, Bruce.
Yeah, oh yeah. So Jim Drake has a real legacy here in Arizona.
Well, give me some information. Give our listeners some information about the nuts and bolts of a recall movement in Arizona. I mean, we're talking about gathering signatures. How many signatures? We're talking about registering voters. How many voters, for example? What is the process? How did it unfold?
Every morning there would be a staff meeting at 8 a.m. in the Phoenix area, if I was running it, and that's the way I set it up under Jim's supervision. And we had, I suppose, the recall through its budget was renting a couple of houses, so a lot of the staff were living together, and frequently, those meetings would be at these houses where our young staff was living, and people would roll out and get a little something to eat, and then we'd have a staff meeting that would last maybe half hour to 45 minutes, decide where everybody was going to go, and usually in pairs. That's my recollection now. I don't think we would have then sent anybody out alone to do this. It could have happened, but people would then head on out. And I did want to share a quick anecdote about this. We had one meeting that may have been in one of the houses, but not everybody obviously stayed in one place. And so we'd like to start on time, and we did. And Johnny Armenta, who was on our staff, walked in after the meeting had started, and I stopped what I was doing. I said, "John, you're late." And John mumbled, "Car trouble." And I said, I fell into it. I said, "John, you don't have a car." He said, "That's the trouble." So after everybody picked themselves up off the floor, we finished our meeting, and John got his petitions, and off he went. That was the way we did it, Leroy. Every day, at least, my recollection is 6 days a week. Sundays would have been a day off, but not Saturdays. And everybody went out. They would come back in, report to a coordinator what they had accomplished, how many signatures they gathered. Bruce, you may need to correct me or Herb. I think we turned in about 106,000 signatures. We probably collected more than that. There would have been some that were duplicates, but that was the number that I recall that was turned
in
to the Secretary of State.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it was actually a little more, but here's the important point, though, Leroy, which is that what happened, we turned these petitions in to the Secretary of State here in Phoenix. He then sent the petitions back to the counties around the state where each of the petition, the pages, the signatures were gathered. The process of verifying those signatures took a number of months. But after that process was completed, we had a sufficient number of signatures to enable us to have a recall election. I mean, it was a huge accomplishment. However, the Attorney General of the state then issued an opinion to the Secretary of State, a fellow named Gary Nelson, saying that all of the signatures obtained by deputy voter registrars, and that was a significant part of our effort, were invalid. And his reasoning was that there was a potential for a deputy voter registrar to coerce a signer into signing the recall petition. Well, that you can see clearly that was completely unsubstantiated. That resulted in a lawsuit that we filed to invalidate that opinion, which we were successful in getting a declaratory judgment. But unfortunately, by that time, the 1974 election had occurred, and and Raul Castro was elected as governor. So it became academic. And so the history is that the efforts of Richard and Jim and others were successful in terms of achieving the goal of getting sufficient signatures, but this opinion of the Attorney General prevented the election from occurring.
So he ran the clock out.
He ran the clock out, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Good way to put it. Good, yeah. Very good way to put it. That's one of the things that that frustrated Jim. So many parts of a multifaceted campaign like that, you just simply don't have control of. And those kinds of politically motivated decisions that had very significant negative effects would have been, I have no doubt, I know this from what Jim suggested to me, was very frustrating to him to try to accomplish the goals of the recall when you weren't holding all of the necessary parts of the strategy in your own
right.
hands to make it happen. It's frustrating.
Well, I want to say something about Herb here at this point, because not only was he someone who, as a political leader, was supportive greatly of this effort, but he really gave of his time. For example, the Maricopa County recorder at that time, Paul Marston, did everything he could to impede this effort. His philosophy, and he was quoted in the paper in a deposition saying that it was the quality of the voter that was more important than the quantity of voters. And so so he adopted a test for deputy voter registrars that you had to be a college graduate in order to understand the questions and to pass the test. And obviously that was completely contrary to any notion about promoting, getting more people involved in democracy and political activity. And so Herb, as a pro bono case, took on a lawsuit to challenge that test, and actually had brought in a national expert or a local expert, and there was actually a trial. And through his efforts, that test was thrown out. And so that litigation really was one of the key milestones in enabling so many people to actually be registered to vote.
And that still is the case today, is that correct?
Yeah, exactly.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We've talked a lot about the legacy, and Bruce and I have particularly talked about the influence of how it had changed Arizona politics. Let me just give one more example. In 1972, when I, as state chairman, I had the notion that we were going to be the first state in the country in democratic politics to have elections in selecting the president of the United States. And so we were. We had the first election run by the Democratic Party and the first election to select delegates for the 1972 convention in Miami. The significance of that was that so many of the young Hispanic people came along, and to a large extent, I mean, in one sense, Cesar Chavez didn't need Arizona and the state Democratic Party to be known nationally, internationally. But in another sense, because the farmworker movement and the state Democratic Party were so intertwined, and I say that in a happy way, of course, that their influence in that process, and ultimately in the convention, and the involvement of so many of the people, and the farm workers movement had national implications for politics, for not only for the movement, but to influence the Democratic Party progressively. And a large part of that, and the reason we're having this conference, is we can talk about the movement, and of course what people know is Cesar Chavez, but what they also need to know is people like Jim Drake and his trusty assistant Vivian and Richard, who put the nuts and bolts and the field leadership that made this thing happen for the benefit of all people in this state and country.
What about the number of voters that were registered during the course of this campaign, or was that significant at all?
I think it was significant, but Leroy, what happened is that our law, I assume it's still the case now, but our law at that time was that if you did not vote in the general election, your name was purged from the registration rolls. And so one of the frustrating things was to see that so many of the people that Richard and his colleagues registered, those names were taken off. And I can remember a meeting. We were all watching the campaign results and the election results at Herb's old house on North Central, where we were sort of assessing how this election would impact the 72 general election, would impact the recall. And that was one of the most devastating things, to see how poorly George McGovern did, not only nationally, but of course here in Arizona, and how that impacted the voter registration statistics. And so we were anticipating that we would have a recall election sometime in 1973, but because so many names were purged because people didn't vote, it really threw really cold water on our perceived viability of being successful in such an election.
Okay. This is so interesting to me. And you've covered so much ground, especially about the long-term impact of this recall movement, as elementary as it was in the very beginning, and how it even comes to the present day in terms of certain precedents that it sets and certain activities, political activities that took place. Could we return for another round, if you can? I'd like to focus on our ending here about Jim Drake's leadership style. I knew Jim Drake, knew him very well. I worked with him, actually, during the fast, Cesar Chavez's fast at Santa Rita's there in Phoenix. And we worked together in the same office, a temporary office. He took care of the media, and I took care of the day-to-day logistics of the fast itself. And so we developed a very close, good working relationship. So I would like to zero in on his leadership style, and I presume there's a lot of pluses, and I presume that there are some minuses. We all have that. So could we make a round there and start with Richard Cook?
I alluded earlier to Jim's ability to inspire confidence in people that he wanted to get a day's work out of. He was just good at that. You felt like if he was in charge, good things were going to happen. If he had made the plan was the best possible plan. And he did that. He had a very endearing way to do that, with anecdotes and with deferential comments, self-deprecating comments, I should say. Jim did not impose or imply that he had to be viewed with deference by anybody. He wanted the work done. He had a job to do like everybody else, and if part of his job was to run a meeting or to make a plan or to hold other people accountable, then that's what he would do. But you didn't ever get the sense that this somehow was set up or structured so that Jim would, at the end of the day, receive a lot of credit for what for the work that a lot of other people did. So I think that's the most telling recollection I have in terms of Jim's leadership style.
Leroy, this is Bruce. What I would say is I got involved when I was 25, and I had just finished law school. I had been a VISTA volunteer. I didn't really see myself as someone who was going to question a lot of the strategic decisions that were being made. I just didn't have that much by way of life experience. So I followed Jim's lead. And so to answer your question, what struck me most about Jim was his strategic thinking about the recall effort, the interplay between the recall effort and the political environment and the legal environment. And so that's what I remember most about him in terms of his ability to understand the interrelationship between all of the moving parts of this rather complex effort and be a very sound strategic thinker about how to move that effort forward.
Yeah, for me, if you talk, indeed, if the word negative is even correct in assessing Jim, it would be that he was a zealot. But he was a zealot for the right reasons. But as a zealot, when I decided not to run, he was disappointed, and that's, I would say, devastated. But devastated, again, for the right reasons, because he was so committed and that it was difficult for him to understand how someone else would not be willing, according to their talents, according to the gifts that were given them educationally and legally, like myself, could not decide to devote their entire life to this effort. And that was his strength, but as Richard said, it never manifested itself in an ego way. You never got the impression that Jim Drake was concerned about himself for himself. That was never it. You were involved, and he got people involved because you vicariously fed off his passion. That was his strength, and that was his greatest legacy.
Very good. On behalf of the Farm Worker Movement Documentation Project, I want to thank each of you for your participation today in our oral history interview about who was Jim Drake. Thank you very much.
Thank you for letting us.
Thank you, Leroy. Richard, I just sent you an email.
Thank you, Bruce, and I'm glad to have your phone number and yours too, Herb, and maybe there's some way we can stay in touch and get connected.
Well,
I'd love to do
absolutely
that.
Absolutely will. Yeah. This is thrilling for me, Richard.
Good.
Thank you.
Thank you, Leroy.
Thank you.